Wait, are you gaming? On a Chromebook?
Yep. It's got a high-res 120Hz display, plus this killer RGB keyboard. And I can access thousands of games anytime, anywhere.
Stop playing.
What?
Get out of here.
Huh?
Yeah, I want you to stop playing and get out of here so I can game on that Chromebook.
Got it.
Go ahead, break it down real low. Discover the ultimate cloud gaming machine, a new kind of Chromebook.
Style. Space. Functionality. The 2023 Chevrolet Traverse is a great option for people with disabilities. It was designed with purposeful solutions that help make driving more accessible, so you can get through the day comfortably and efficiently, no matter where you need to go. Chevy Accessibility. Engineered to go forward. Learn more at chevy.com/accessibility.
And welcome back to a bonus episode of There Will Be Dungeons. We do this for our supporters, and then everyone else gets it a week after that. If you're getting it a week after that, consider being a supporter and you can get it early. For those who are getting it early, you guys are awesome. We're going to jump right in this week, or this month, rather, and have Kristen lay out a few questions for us. Kristen, what do we have this week?
All right, so to start things off, we've got one question for each of the player characters here. And the first one is, will Hope ever find her six shooters?
Ooh. Will you?
I mean, I hope so, but at the same time, as a fighter now, I get three attacks per round. So I would need so much ammo to make sure I could actually use them through an entire fight that I kind of just want to switch Hope to melee now.
Oh my gosh. Would you allow that, though?
I mean, she's got her dagger.
I'm trying to remember.
There was that pile of junk in the Nash Tower, but we never stopped by it. And I'm pretty sure the guns could have been found in there because I think that's where Smokey's belt was, too. But Hope didn't know about that or ask about it, so it was just completely left unexplored.
Remember where they are either. I feel like they turned up at some place.
I think they were on Sigil, right? Because they were dragon metal.
Oh, did they survive?
Yeah, maybe. I think they were in the sewers there.
Yeah, because didn't we... I mean, that's where Nash got his dildo umbrella. And we went looking for it.
Yeah.
And I feel like maybe we found one of them, but then what happened to it? I don't know. They're gone. They're lost to time.
John's giving up.
He's They're gone. Yeah, I don't...
They are somewhere.
But I was going to ask, are you... I mean, Bo's not going to say, but you're probably aware where it is, right?
I mean, it'd be a shame for them to go missing forever, but I feel like you guys have a pretty good instinct about where they might turn up.
Interesting. Yeah, I'd like to see Hope get her stuff back. I'm not so worried about the dildo or whatever else. I have
content
the dildo.
Maybe with a new item is in the horizon.
Oh. That'd be pretty fun.
Ooh. Well... we'll have to wait and find out.
Yep. This next one is for Nash. Will multi-Nash help Nash remember his or their past?
Multi-Nash.
Well, all the Nashes that you asked Zolfenjal to help Zolfenjal to help you conjure up back at Planet Nash.
Right. Aren't we still... I don't remember how we left that. Because we were asking for a bunch of Nash help.
Yeah, he said his abilities were on cooldown, so he needed a bit of time. And you guys decided when you return, you'll pick up the Nashes rather than haul them across the galaxy with you.
Okay, that makes
just because they might be a little chaotic. There's some concern. Some concern was expressed, and it was decided that maybe we'll wait till we get back.
Yeah,
that's that what makes I remember.
Sense. I have a feeling they'll want to help. Why wouldn't they? They're Nashes. Nashes generally, they're just a little stupid and weird sometimes, but they all want to fix this problem, especially if ours is the prime timeline, like everyone seems to be indicating, like we're the ones that are going to finally get this done, then why wouldn't they all want to not have all their work go in vain? They can continue, they can help shore up the effort to make sure we succeed. So if I was to bet, I would say Nashes are all in. The collective of Nashes on the macro are all in.
Nice.
Yep. May our
will they help you discover your past?
Well, God rest our souls.
Do they think they'll be helpful in that way?
Yeah, would Nash even want to know about his past, or he knows his own past, so he doesn't care?
That's a great question. He doesn't care so much, but they've all either failed or... Right, Bo? They've all either failed at their job or they're not there yet.
Yeah, there seems to be an ongoing time conundrum.
Right. So because of that, it just seems to me like they would be like, well, if this is our way to get the job done, let's just do it. And let's work with this Nash and get it done. You know, whatever their misgivings might be about the situation.
I mean, it's one of those weird things where it's like, do I know or does Scott know? Because it's his character.
Yeah, I don't actually know.
It's sort of up to you to, you know, when we get to that situation, we'll have to, we'll figure it out.
Yeah, we'll figure it out.
It's going to be weird, probably.
Yeah. But I don't know. I have faith. I have faith the Nashes will want to do what's best. And in this case, helping us would be best. So it's purely speculation until we get there, but I think they'll probably want to help.
Awesome. Next one is for Stanley. And it is initially worded, would Stanley become more optimistic now that he's a leader? But is Stanley more optimistic now that he's a leader, now that a few episodes have gone by?
It's an interesting idea. Like, I would think Stanley would actually become less optimistic as a leader, because like the reason he's sad all the time is he takes everything very personally and everything very seriously and failure very hard. And so the weight of leadership would not temper that. It would actually make it worse. But I do think that this recent stint of not having any wisdom, like, kind of lends credence to what Varel always put him in check with, right? Because Varel always said, you know, hey, you worry too much. You got to just get out there and do it. Like, you know, this is how you should lead. And Stanley always discounted it because he always thought, well, of course that's what Varel says, but I'm smart and I'm not going to do it that way. So he looked down on the idea. But now he's done it and it's been successful. And I think that adds more credence to Varel's argument. And I think maybe that's a bit more eye-opening to Stanley, that, like, you know, maybe there is a lesson to be learned there. And I kind of feel like with leadership, you go through this, you know, you go through this initial thing of like, oh, I'm going to be the best and I'm going to take care of everybody. And, you know, I'm going to be a great leader for my people. And I think there's an inevitable realization that you can't save and protect everyone. And that sometimes leadership comes with not making easy decisions. And it's what you do with that acceptance that actually determines if you're going to be a good leader or not. And I don't think Stanley's there yet. But I think, like, the wisdom thing is step one on kind of figuring out where he's going to be. But I think having wins is what will ultimately make Stanley more optimistic. He definitely feels like he loses a lot. I think that's where Sadly Billings comes from.
Sadly Billings?
Has anybody actually called you that?
Just me.
Just you?
Just what I refer to him as whenever he's sad.
I love that.
Yeah, that's adorable. Yeah. In a way.
Next one is for Varel here. Is the Union of Tribes in the future?
They talking about the lizard folk? Because I think we put them all on one ship. So in desperation, they're pretty much
so
unionized.
I would assume so, because it's got Hope, Nash, Stanley. I would assume this is for Varel.
It could also be for Bok Bok, who was off to unite the tribes of goblins.
Well, then in that case, possibly, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's in NPC hands now.
Yep.
Yeah, you'll have to see what happens with that. I don't want to give it all away.
How long has it been since we've seen Bok Bok? It's been a while, right?
2 days?
Yeah. Oh, is that all? Never mind.
He's still midway through your own task, so, you know, who knows how long you're going to be.
Yeah.
Hopefully not long.
Time in D&D is weird. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Time can pass.
Yeah.
Oddly. Yeah. The next one is for Bo and Kyle. As DMs, when you set up a puzzle, trap, or encounter for the players, Do you think of a way out of it during planning, or do you just think of interesting scenarios and see what the players come up with without knowing yourself if it's solvable?
I actually have had that question before. That's a great question.
I think you do a bit of both. I think it's a hybrid of both, in my opinion, because if you come up, there's this kind of problem with puzzles where basically it's kind of like a DPS check in RL rather than an RP, in the sense that, you know, you're like playing these fantasy characters, but then you put this puzzle and then you're asking people to be like, solve this puzzle. And it's not really about the characters, and it's about, you know, are the players good at Sudoku or whatever? So, you know, if they have that, then they'll be like, I know this, and they can just solve it. And if the players don't, then it's like, they're like, well, I just don't know. I'm not good at these kinds of puzzles, so I guess we're not going to solve it. So it's like, you kind of got to leave out, I feel. Like, you can do a puzzle and be like, you know, here's a... Often in video games, they have those rotation puzzles where you got to rotate statues and the right thing, and then you can get through or something like that. It's like, I think you do leave opportunity for weird things to happen. So if they decide to smash all the puzzles because they got a barbarian who, that puzzle make me head hurt. Mm-hmm. Maybe you leave yourself an out where that might trigger an outcome or a negative thing, right? Like, you want kind of want to have a interactive world. So sometimes you can anticipate those things and build them into your puzzle. Like, what are some alternative workarounds? Sometimes if you hear a good idea, maybe you're coming up with the solution on the fly that lets them move forward. So it's kind of this, at least my approach is a mash of all of it, I think. Right. Like, an example would be like that last bank door. There was a way to solve the code, right? Which would be to maybe do some skill checks along the lines of sleight of hand or of investigation or perception, depending on if someone wanted to try and figure out what the code was. Or, you know, how did you guys end up solving it? You guys basically, someone teleported through, right? Like, Stanley, you teleported through and opened the door from the other side. I think that's what happened. Not the intended solve for a puzzle, like a locked door with a combination lock on it, but perfectly, you know, acceptable, especially with magic that can circumvent all kinds of rules. They can undermine your puzzles quite effectively in some cases, especially if you didn't. I didn't really think about the teleportation when I came up with that quote puzzle. It was just like, what would a bank have for normal non-magic people to keep them out? And then, you know, magic people are like circumvent the laws of reality, so people don't account for these kinds of things depending on the security level of the building. So is that kind of give an idea? You got to kind of think about all of it, I guess. You know, don't get too clever with the puzzle side of things. And
what would you say?
Let Kyle answer too a bit, because he's got an opinion.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's a good way to put it. Because, and certainly at our level, being level 13, it's a power fantasy to just trump a puzzle and just completely bulldoze it with magic. And yeah, you get like a spell per day out of it. So the DM wins a little bit, depending on their balance and upcoming encounters. But you have to take it out of video game logic. So video games, like old Scooby-Doo episodes, you can see the book in the shelf on the wall that they're going to touch in Scooby-Doo.
Yeah.
Because that book's going to move.
Yeah.
And video games are the same way. You walk in a room and options come up. So puzzles are always presenting the answers to you in those interactive mediums. But in D&D... the puzzle is infinitely harder because anything is possible. So there was a puzzle I did it was the episode where Ben guested. We did the double dungeons, the two hallways, and you had to describe symbols back and forth to each other.
Oh, yeah. I remember that.
That worked in character because it is an extremely simple puzzle of description in character to each other. But as Bo kind of brought up, that the logic side of puzzles, riddles, you have to be really careful with, because those are asking the player to be in charge of their own brain and maybe smarter than their own character is. And some people are just amazing at puzzles. Like, I've done Sudoku as like a doorway puzzle, and I've had groups that are just stumped and no one plays Sudoku. And then you've got the one guy who goes on, you know, trips every week on the plane, whiz at Sudoku, just plows through your dungeon.
Yeah.
And he's playing the barbarian. It's like, how does the barbarian know
that? So it's driving him insane, too, because he's role-playing really well. You're, like, giving out inspiration, trying to reward the poor player who is holding back and not solving all the puzzles. So I think those more physics-based puzzles, or like that imagery puzzle in the double dungeon was a description-based puzzle, allows people to stay in character.
And then you could also use the skill checks to, you know, if the player isn't good at Sudoku, but the character, they're playing a smart little wizard, you give them the spell check, like you give them a skill check or some sort of in-game rule option that gives them the solution to, or gives them a hint towards the solution.
It's amazing when you look at video games in a D&D sphere. I mean, we all kind of do this with invisible walls in video games, but like Half-Life, like if Gordon Freeman could just scramble a little bit, I wouldn't have to go find three barrels to make this lever lift.
Right.
So, like, even those are off the table.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that it didn't have to be barrels here in D&D, it could be anything, means very, very, very simple traps and puzzles can take an hour.
Yeah.
Then you want to get your ego out of it, because then if you spend 8 hours on your puzzle and the players are like totally like, what's this stupid puzzle? Oh, my God. And you're like, we're spending out. You know, you want to like just make sure you don't over invest emotionally in your what you come up with either, because players will react in unpredictable ways and they may not like it or whatever. And that's totally acceptable. But if you got to depersonalize it, because if you spend a long time on something fancy and they just, you know, it just doesn't resonate and they may be extreme, you might get protective of your creation, and you want to watch out for that too. So, you know, keep them straightforward, I think.
Let me ask you this question, Bo. When we're as high level as we are and you have a puzzle you need solved, or you got a dangerous place and you know that, for example, I'll just use me because I don't want to assume anyone else, but if you present something weird, there's a decent chance Nash wants to go smell it or lick it or touch it. Have you ever been in a, every time I do that, I go, oh, I hope Bo didn't make this thing to be like the ultimate death trap. And I'm just going to, this is the end of Nash. Goodbye, everybody. We're done with him forever. Have you ever had to like shift gears and decide that it was a little less lethal because Nash wanted to lick something or smell something or whatever?
I mean, I guess I'm not super big on puzzles. So just for that reason, you know, in the game, like I feel like the puzzle is more the exploration puzzle, like figuring out what to do next, figuring out how to resolve this situation like that, you know, that it's not a traditional puzzle, but we just ended on there's like this hole that goes to nowhere. And you guys solved the puzzle by sending one of your own in to take to see what happens. Right. Like it's a puzzle. There's an unknown thing beyond a gateway. There's a number of ways of approaching it, right? Like you could dip your hand in, like there's all kinds of, like that in itself is a puzzle and can be rewarding if the players figure out a way to safely navigate into the next room. So like it's also keeping in mind that like the nature of D&D can be just that, right? Like I think if you get to these fancy puzzle rooms or word riddles or things like that, I'm not super big on those, so I don't know that I do them very often. You want just enough to make the adventure feel like an adventure. Like if there was a wizard in a tower and with a locked room that was overly elaborate, you want to put something ridiculous in there, but you know, I'm not trying to stump anybody with it, I guess I'm not sure if that answers your question, but
well, no, it does actually. I mean, I guess what I'm asking is let's say you made a death portal and the idea is that anything that went in there, even the smallest bug or the biggest troll walked through that death portal, they'd be immediately fried. That was your plan.
Mm-hmm.
And we walked into that room and Nash goes, "Whoa, check it out," and puts his hand in it. Would you feel like you had to adhere to your pre-planned rule that this thing is instant death upon contact? Or would you have to on the fly go, "All right, well, fine. We'll just have Nash lose a finger."
So the philosophy is this: anything that has very dire consequences, I'm doing foreshadowing, you know, applying cinematic rules to do foreshadowing. So maybe a mosquito flies into it and dies instantly or explodes.
Oh.
I try to at least drop a hint so that if someone does something stupid, they go, I can point and say like, well, you know, that mosquito flew in and died and then you went and walked in and now you're dead. So oops, to you. Like, yeah. I don't feel bad if I can foreshadow something with a dire consequence. Like, I'm really not trying to blindside players unless, I mean, if I had a group of players sit down and be like, you know what, we just want you to ravage us with difficulty, then I'd be like, okay, then here we go. But like, that's down to the player contract and knowing your players. Yeah. Generally speaking, I've never really played it with anyone like that. Most people want to have a good time. So just like, I mean, with some small exceptions, like when I died to a fan in Disco Elysium for trying to turn a fan off, I got a heart attack or something like that. Like, with some small exceptions, is generally not what people are looking for, but they want to feel like they're dealing in danger. So I think if anything has big consequences, I'm probably doing foreshadowing, or I'm dropping some hint or something just to get everyone thinking, so that, you know, I'd feel guilty, you know, just turfing somebody's character instantaneously. So I want to sleep well at night too. So I'll do that.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah. At least apply the foreshadowing and not try to do it. I mean, the better you're doing it, the less obvious you're being about it, hopefully. And it's just transparent. Like, just someone picks up on the detail and doesn't even remember why they're thinking that way. But, you know, it's sort of in there. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Is that the same for you, Kyle, by the way? Just curious. When you, that sort of thing, is that like, I can't just kill this character, so I got to backtrack what I was thinking. The sort of thing fascinates me. I don't know why, but.
So for me, it's about no wasted damage. If there's going to be damage in a trap, that means that there's a combat later that I'm trying to drain resources for. Otherwise, we're just wasting time.
Hmm.
So, One thing I talk a lot about on, you know, the learning shows I do, like DM gives inspiration and stuff of that nature, is slides, not spikes. So the idea that when a pit opens, you actually are embedded deeper in the dungeon and you slide down, taking no damage, but it propels people along the story. Whereas if you just fall in a pit, not only is the person who's more likely to fall in that pit the wizard, so they're going to have the most trouble getting out of the pit, and it's a whole big deal. Everyone doesn't have to put down the ropes and we have to bring them out. It's just a pause to all the action.
Gotcha.
So it's way more exciting to have that actually be a slide that takes someone deeper, or somehow the puzzle is a propelling force, or it's an opportunity for role play, which is also keeping that ball rolling.
Right. Interesting.
But the direct answer is, yeah, there is a type of game like that. And it's called Tomb of Horror, or it's these Tomb of Annihilation kind of things where everyone shows up and they have like three characters and they're going to Dark Souls, for lack of a better phrase, this dungeon. We're going to run at it and we're going to go three rooms, dead. Awesome. Next character, five rooms. Whoa. Awesome. Next character. Okay. We got to the final boss.
Oh, interesting. They're almost like lives then. Like three lives. Okay. Yeah. I suppose there's a style there's a place for that.
Yeah. And I guess, all the players in the DM agreeing that that's going to be the style, right? Because everyone wants to play a game, but we all want to agree that the rules are what we all consider fair.
Yeah. I mean, in high school or junior high, when I played way back, there might be a kid no one liked, and so they'd figure out a way to kill his character, but that's because we were immature buttholes, you know?
It's called bullying.
Yeah, we were
come play D&D with us. Yeah. Oh, your character's dead. Oopsies.
We were a bunch of, you know,
pinheads. How many hours you spend coming up with it?
Exactly. So go get us Cokes, because you're dead. You know, that kind of attitude.
Yeah. There's metagaming too. Like, once you start not killing people, then the players start assuming they're not going to die.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to combat that at the same time. So one puzzle I like to do in one shots is there's a small room full of acid, like pouring down, and someone walks into it and their character, skeleton falls to the ground. They melt. It's actually a teleporter, and the skeleton melting part is an illusion.
Hmm. Oh.
So one by one, you know, now that person in the other room, they can start making their way back and maybe even reveal they're okay. I opened the door, everybody. But the people left in the room have to decide, is this a teleporter? You know, where did that person go, or are they dead? And you can't do that trap later on once they kind of metagame you.
Right. That's interesting. It's like it's a little bit of a Lich King thing. Everyone's dead, not really. But you felt like you were, you know, like you felt like that stuff was real and the danger was bad. Like when Bo had to bring us back from, when I was just a heart, a floating heart, that was intense. I didn't know how we were going to ever be whole again. Like, that felt like real consequences.
No, you all probably should have died there.
Yeah.
Like the way that I had originally envisioned that area, like, I wasn't quite sure where it was leading, but I was putting somebody in a position to sacrifice themselves to the rest of the party. Yeah. And you guys surprised me by just all committing seppuku, basically. And just like, let's all die.
Yeah. We're
going to die. We'll all die. You know, and I had ideas what I might do with something, but I just wanted to put somebody, I wanted to have somebody to have that heroic moment of, I'll be the one to sacrifice. You know, there's a cinematicness to it. And, you know, that's how I concocted this magic device that somebody would have to offer their life energy to seal the gateway and to see where that took us. So I wasn't sure what to do with it. Like, we could have just ended there, but I was reading Planescape at the time. So I was like, I got an idea. And then we just went that direction.
Yeah.
Which took us in a very circuitous or whatever. It took us in a very roundabout way to some other direction that was very pleasant and fun and hilarious, but wasn't planned before the event, right? Like, I was just right. Like, I guess they're all dead, but I think I remember saying, like, we'll see what happens. And I was like, I don't know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
These situations come up way more. I remember that one too. And that's me metagaming. I basically metagamed Bo Schwartz there by saying he wouldn't kill the whole party, right? Everybody in. And that's,
yeah. Like, if I was like, nope, you have to obey what you originally planned, then yes, everyone would be dead. It was going to kill somebody.
But I think something you might be curious about, Scott, is like when that moment happens. Mm-hmm. And that happens when you as a player disrespect the strategy of the situation. Mm-hmm. And for the most player kills, that's where I've always heard it happen in Critical Role. It's happened in my own games. It's when, like, usually it's a sorcerer of some kind, warlock, they fly up above a whole range of archers and isolate themselves, or they run at the boss solo or whatever. They tactically don't respect the big bad or the situation they're in. And a puzzle, you can be like, let me tone down the damage, let me tone down this, but when they jump out solo in front of 20 archers, that's when you're kind of like, as DM, well, crap.
Yeah.
I have to fire. These are NPCs, have their own lives and their own situations. I have to let loose the arrows.
Yeah. That's interesting.
Like, you guys are all fairly cautious in combat, I will say. Like, almost frustrated. Like, not in a bad way. Don't take it the bad way. But, like, Stanley, especially John, is frustratingly cautious. It's been very refreshing to see him not be cautious, because you know, it's like, it's very like cautious play. Like, it's okay. It's just very tough to challenge people that are smart in that way, you know? So, that's a great, it's just Kyle, you thinking that, you know, it's like some people when they play, they fantasize just being superpowered. So they run into, I mean, I did it when I was pretending to be an actor in my game. I was so eager to act. And I knew it wasn't long for this world, because I could tell the DM was already getting impatient with me. I gutted a wolf and put on the wolf costume and was acting. I was like, I'm going to scout ahead acting as a wolf with a gutted out wolf costume. But the barbarian was like running ahead of me to go fight things. And I'm like, no, I'm going to act our way through this. Yeah. And it's like, I think the thing is like we you know, got clobbered because of how stupid we were behaving, right? Like, and that's sort of the point, is you guys are all very like, let's think about this. Let's be careful.
Yeah, I don't want to.
Let's hold back. And we don't really have a Drax, I guess, in the group, right? Who's just like, yeah, you guys are taking too long. I'm running through the door.
I mean, Varel is sort of our Drax, but not in a, it's not reckless. But
he has wisdom. Reckless. Like Varel is like that. He's a barbarian, but he's a very wise barbarian. I would say, like, he's, you know, like you, like Stanley was very refreshing the other day. He was just like, yeah, I just teleport through it. Let's go.
Yeah.
Whatever.
He doesn't have the wisdom to know he should save his spells in case things get bad. He's just like, oh, I have a way through this gate. Use a spell. Yeah. Oh, I took 9 points of damage. Use a spell. Oh, I feel a little weird. Use a spell. Like, just get rid of all that caution. It was a fun way to play, too. Like, that's the other thing, is that was a super fun way to play that character. I don't know if I'd want to do it all the time, but it was a different change that I really enjoyed.
That's the counterintuitive thing about D&D, where you're like, I'm trying to win, and trying to win means surviving and doing combat correctly. But at the same time, you're like, I'm also trying to have fun.
And yeah, I mean, that's why Dying Talus was the most fun I've had in the campaign, right? Because I didn't care, and I didn't have to care anymore. And all of a sudden, it's just like, go crazy. Who cares?
And, you know, at the end of the day, I mean, you grow attached to your characters. You don't want to lose them, but, you know, you can always roll another character, you know. And so
we're also MMO gamers, and MMO gamers are the worst for D&D combat because they never pull aggro. Like, we all understand, you throw open the door, ping, 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 20 people all go, and attack, you know, the wizard who opened the door. You play with people who play first-person shooters, you know, play Animal Crossing. They're going to make tons of tactical mistakes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's actually a really good point. I think MMO gamers come to D&D, especially if that's where they're starting, or, you know, they've never played D&D before, but they started playing MMOs as kind of their RPG experience. I think that totally colors how you even see an encounter. Like,
that's a good point. Yeah. You know? Yeah. Cause you have like the assigned roles. You just have muscle memory about it. The tank draws aggro, the wizard, you know, the blasters blast from the back.
Yeah.
The rogues stay unseen. Like, there's definitely, tactics wise, like, the tactics are not that different in D&D in terms of the class role assignment. So that's
well, perfect. And there's that social contract on top of it, because I've played with people who only play like XCOM, and they're not good D&D gamers, because they just, in their mind, they're just like, just reload, just no, I take it back.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, and you pull wrong in Serpent Shrine Caverns, you're dead. Yeah. And everyone has to go walk all the way back.
Yeah, that's an interesting comparison. Well, that was a good. We got a lot out of that question.
And I'm more like, is it just when I DM? I'm because there's a tactical battle where we could do a series of, you know, balanced matches. You know, there's 8 goblins to your 4 party members, and you're gonna do, you know, 3 or 4 encounters. I just like throwing the whole dungeon at you in one count. You know, just like, you know, I like the big monstrous epic battles that are.
Sure, and you'll adjust as needed, fun. So that we're not, you know, dying in the first 10 minutes, but, you know, that's what.
Yeah, well, I give consideration to the fact that, like, you know, you're playing heroes, and it is possible for you to die and get injured, but at the same time, I don't know. I just thought sometimes the most epic battles can be the small ones, right? Like, one of my group's first battles against 6 wolves almost destroyed them, and it's the battle that's most talked about. But, you know, as you get powers, like, certain things become trivial. So, and I find, like, the how many encounters can you get done in a day kind of thing? Like, it's hard. Like, again, as MMO players, you're saving your ultimates for, like, you know, instinctively to save your spell, like your bloodlust for when it's needed. You're not using, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
It's just kind of hard. And like, your spell slots are kind of like that, right? You're just like, is it time to bloodlust? I don't think so. So we're not going to use it.
Yeah, I don't. It's like, I always worry about that with the dragon thing. I hold on to it way too long. And I'm like, well, I don't want to be standing there in dragon form and not have lifted a finger. And that has happened a couple of times where I pop dragon and then it was like, well, didn't need that. But I also get way too conservative with it.
Yeah, I don't know how else they balance the game without putting a limitation like that. But it would be nice if there was a different solution.
Yeah.
Where, like, I think 4E sort of had it where they had their, at wheels, but they had once per encounter. So rather than abilities requiring a long rest, you could use it one time in every battle, and that was it.
Mm.
And then you had your dailies, but the dailies would be like sort of, you know, bigger epic things on the order of wish or you know, world changing or very dramatically impacting things. But they saved a pretty good tier of spells for the per encounter, so you never felt like, well, if I use a spell slot, it's gone. But I think a lot of people, there's a lot of desire when 5e was being made for, you know, classic D&D, and classic D&D spellcasting had the slots. But I actually think there's some really good ideas in 4e, a lot that didn't carry over into 5e. That's kind of a shame. So, yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah, because the once per encounter meant that maybe if you do have a spell that you'd hold on to, you weren't worried about not having it the next battle.
But there was also, like, only combat encounters. So, like, I remember having a whole group sitting around trying to light the knight's fire at the campsite. And they're like, you're constantly throwing fireballs. I'm like, I know, but I'm not in combat. And the tiefling's like, well, I can make fire. Well, no, I'm not in combat. So they, like, wanted to go piss off a squirrel. so they could be in combat just to light the fire.
Yeah, No, there were good ideas in 4E, but not the. I'm not saying 4E was the best system for sure. Like, there's definitely that weirdness where I can't use this because I'm not in combat. You're absolutely right. That's weird.
But we just house ruled it, and it was fine. There are things. Yeah, the balance is really nice.
I mean, too. A combination of both would be good. Like, you could use it out of combat so many times a day. I don't know. We're not gonna redesign 4E here, I guess. But there were just good aspects of it. I feel, and I think the spell slot thing is very much a like. Like, I've noticed in your guys' play, like, I don't want to use it. Then you're like, well, 6 weeks goes by and you haven't used your cool spell that you like because it makes sense to hold on to it. But it's, it just feels bad. And you're like, I'm a wizard. Like, that's why Bardic Inspiration, I totally forgot about it. And I'm like, how? And that's not even that big of a deal. And I'm like, it barely gets used, Mm-hmm. That's a bit of a shame.
Yeah. Or did we lose?
I think we answered the shit out of that question.
Yeah. Did we still have time for one more?
Yeah, we can do one more.
All right, cool. I'm sorry if this has been answered before, but after listening to the White Tower episodes, which have been my absolute favorite so far, finding myself wanting to learn more about Euphemius. A quick Google search didn't turn up much. Was he homebrewed for the campaign, or do I just need to get good at using a search engine? Love the show. Thanks so much for all the work that goes into it. Also, Walnut Rocks.
First of all, thank you for saying you like the White Tower. I get I don't know about you guys, but I get self-conscious that certain arcs suck and stuff. And there's been conversations in Discord where I liked it in the Waste. I don't like it in Planescape and blah, blah, blah. And that's cool.
But I liked the White Tower a lot for what it's worth. I thought that was a strong arc.
Yeah.
I just appreciate when people they drop by on my stream too. And they'd be like, I love this episode. It always makes me feel good. So I just want to say thank you for including that. Euphemius Zorander, though, stop searching. Euphemius Zorander was actually an original name of one of my PCs in sort of my play with other friends. So
nice.
Do not Google him. He's not real thing. So I sort of included one of my, that's actually Euphemius Zorander. The great Euphemius Zorander is the actor. Although I don't think that is necessarily the same character as this. There wouldn't be any more backstory to that, but, I don't think this reveals too much. I think the relationship you would have learned between the voice and the fist, because the hand, Zorander's fist was where the hand was in. So one can imagine that what Hope is going through is what Euphemius Zorander went through as he bore the fist over top of the hand. And it's too bad. The rules text for Zorander's fist was a mile long. So if anyone actually, I was hoping Kyle would wield it as a fist weapon, but that never happened.
Didn't happen.
that's a good example of probably 4 to 8 hours spent on rules text for an item that just got given. I don't want this.
Sure. That's great. I love when people think you made, or they think you've got something that's some official thing, but really you made it up. And I think that's awesome.
Yeah, it was really complex. It was there's different kinds of punches. You could do crazy uppercut and do a big ground slam. I really went to town picturing all kinds of fun fist things.
Oh, that's awesome.
On it. Yeah, it was big. But it's gone now, I guess.
Now it's gone. There you go. Hopefully that answers all of your questions. We'll get to more of these next month for our bonus monthly show. And another additional huge thanks to everybody who supports us on the site. Tell your friends and head on over there. therewillbedungeons.com. We'll be back next month with more. We'll see you then. Yeah.
And I love